Shalom, everybody, and welcome to the Yishai Fleisher Show, broadcasting live from Jerusalem to the world. You're part of it wherever you are. Shalom, and welcome to the Land of Israel Network, this incredible network that is the home of wondrous shows, true deep knowledge, and your connection wherever you are to what's happening here in the ingathering of the exiles here in this holy land. And God's dream coming true, and His promise coming true, and that's what's happening here. It's no bigger, no smaller than that. You know, it's just the vision of God coming to fruition, God's promises coming to fruition. We're going to be talking about that on today's show, and I am pleased and honored to be joined today by Rabbi Mike Foyer. Rabbi Mike, shalom and welcome.
Oh, shalom Yishai. It's good to see you.
It's great to see you, and it's great to be here at Beit Midrash Sulam Yaakov, and we're in the ante room or whatever this thing is.
We like to call it the conference room.
The conference room. Okay.
It ups our rent.
Yeah. it's a modest conference room indeed, but a holy one, and that holiness makes up for
the deco.
Yeah. But I'm looking through the blinds here, the curtains, and I just see the lights reflecting from the synagogue. And outside I see the grayness of the sky. The grayness of the sky is, you just made a hand pumping motion, which is a joyous feeling for us,
yes,
here in Israel.
We absolutely.
Were like, and it's I've talked about this many times, but it's one of these things where you're like, when you have somebody visiting from America and they're like, nasty weather out there today, and you're like,
what,
dude? you haven't gotten the reset button done yet. You really have to understand that there's a great feeling of warmth inside the shul, inside Beit Midrash Sulam Yaakov here in Nachlaot Yerushalayim. And a great feeling that a weather system is coming. And I even heard a minister today, Ophir Akunas, mm-hmm, talk about a lot of things. And amongst them, just he's like an amateur meteorologist, being so excited for the rain that's coming. And the lady on the radio station, and by the way, my brother, God bless him, Josh Fleischer, who's a great videographer here in Israel, if you ever need him, he said to me, he found the radio station, I think I told you about it, Kan Moreshet, Moreshet, okay? And this Moreshet is like a more religious a type of radio station, and it has saved my life. It has made me feel so much better, so much more connected when I'm driving, instead of all that cynicism.
Yeah, this negativity in media is really a sickness.
Right, and then when you're in a more religious station, suddenly all the cynicism kind of drops off, not all.
Not all of it, unfortunately, but a lot.
But a good chunk of it, and just they were like, and it's important to pray, and the minister, Akunas, who, by the way, came to Chevron, I spent a day with him. I really liked his style. Just was like, it's very important to pray, and at the same time, it's so wonderful to say. I don't know. He was just very positive and strong on all the issues, and it was great. So it's a wonderful day here in Yerushalayim, Yer HaKodesh, and we always, every day, have to be just like wowed by this great time. Those of you who recall, Rabbi Mike, we have a lot of issues to cover today.
Oh, we have a lot of issues.
We have a lot of issues to cover today, so buckle in, folks. We've got a lot of very serious issues to cover. All of them are serious, with the exclusion of this one. It was going to be serious, but it wasn't. As I may have mentioned on last week's show, my son was scratched by a cat.
Cat scratch.
Cat scratch.
That's lead cat scratch fever. It can be quite dangerous.
It could be cat scratch fever, and it turns out that cats lick their nails.
That's why it's so dangerous.
Right.
They lick their paws. That's how they clean themselves.
They lick their paws.
And they eat all kinds of stuff. Here in Israel, of course, the natural habitat of a cat is the dumpster.
Right.
So therefore, when they lick their paws, it's not so clean.
Okay. And so there's cat fever, whatever it's called, and then there's cat scratch fever, and then there's also the scare of rabies.
Yeah.
So basically, it turns out this is going to be important for everybody to hear, because there's actually a lesson in this for everybody. It turns out that I had to go to the Ministry of Health, report the cat scratch. Now, I was so dumb about it, I had no idea. I actually thought that my son getting scratched by a cat would actually be a good thing for him, because he's like a wild kid, and
like
I don't wanted him to
calm him down or something.
No, I wanted him to understand the borders. Like, he was jumping on this cat and scratched him. I was like, good. He'll learn the
good cat. Teach him a lesson.
Well, at least understand what the level borders of engagement.
Get bit.
Yeah, not bit.
Scratch.
Yeah, bit. It would have been even worse.
My wife got bit by a cat.
Anyway, so we were all going about to, now. My son is two. And so they want to put him under for this cat scratch to get the various shots.
Right.
They wanted to shoot to do injections around the scratch and then intravenously, a whole spiel.
Wow.
And I was like, and then it turns out that you got to try to catch the cat.
Yes.
Well, it turns out that in the great city of Efrat, catching a cat is somehow beyond the capacity of
the city.
They're unable to do it. It turns out that some kids mess with the traps, and it was just a comedy of errors, really. And then now here's what people don't know about rabies. If you see the cat in 10 days, it's all
still
over.
Alive.
It's still,
yeah.
If it's still alive and fine, it's all over.
Yes, that's right.
Because it's only during that 10-day...
incubation period.
Right. Where it,
before it kills its host.
Right. Before rabies basically kills you.
Yeah.
So I started looking for this cat.
That gleam in your eye.
Yeah. Started looking for the cat. I did an old school investigation, talk to people, show them pictures, put out an APB.
Have you seen this cat?
Yeah, have you seen this cat? Stopping people in the streets, stopping.
Excuse me, sir. Have you
seen
this cat?
And when you approach people, you know, people not always are people like, you know, hi.
You're armed.
Right.
You're dangerous.
I'm trying to I'm looking for a cat. Any case. Then I remembered that I have to pray to God, not just for the health of my kid, but even to find this thing. There's a prayer that I really, really believe in. And it's a saying that we say, Rabbi Binyamin Omer, Rabbi Binyamin says, Hakol bechazkat suman, everybody is like blind, Ad shekodesh baruch hu ma'ir etenahem, until God reveals their eyes. And this is a prayer that people say when you lost something. And it's not a charm, and it's not a, you know, it's not a magic trick. What it is the saying to God, I realize that things are hidden from my eyes. And it's because you've chosen to hide them from my eyes. Many times the prophets will say, oh, and God hid this from my eyes. So I said this prayer, and I prayed and prayed. And then I also did my
Ishtadlus,
my actual work in the field. And indeed, the cat turned out. It's fine. It says hi. It's a big fan of the Ishai Fleischer show and the network in general. And the cat is dandy. I can tell you how it takes its coffee and where it lives. The cat is fine and dandy, but it turned out afterwards that a lot of people were like, yeah, I see that cat all the time. Sure, the cat's fine. And my wife, she gets a little pedantic about things like this, you know, about the potential rabies death of our child. So she was quite upset about this whole thing. Anyway, it turned out the cat was, how should we say, well-known and prominent, okay? All I'm trying to say to you folks is that there are things right before us, but we don't necessarily see them.
This is true.
And we have to ask God to help us see things, including, for example, the good sides of our spouse, the good sides of ourself, the good sides of life, career opportunities that are many times right before our very eyes, and yet we don't see them open to us. And it's important. It's important to do your darndest, yet at the same time to really turn to God and to say, you know, it's your world. It's your world of possibilities. It's your world of things. If this thing is lost, I'm not going to flip out. I'm going to say, you know, God, help me see it. Help me see this thing. And if I don't find it, that's also for the good. And really to have a relationship with those struggles with God at that very moment.
Well, there's important life balance that you have to strike there, because we are meant to try as hard as possible to succeed in the world, whether it's in finding what's lost, whether it's in achieving our goals, what have you. But sometimes our success, or just even the efforts that we put out, blind us to the fact that it's not in our control. And so therefore, there's a very powerful combination I hear in that, in doing the effort and then praying to God, saying, listen, don't let me be limited by my abilities.
I personally like it the reverse order than that. I like to pray, then do.
Okay.
I think you pray, and then you go out and you do the thing.
Whatever works.
I learned it in the Army. There was a whole... One time we were about to have a test on the four-wheel drive vehicles we were driving, and I saw one, and we had to pick like one of five little cars to drive, and it was like two people to a car, and there was one that had like a license plate that added up to like 18 and it had a sticker, but the guy that was with me, a secular guy, says to me, yeah, but look at the tires. The tires are like rubbed out. We're not going to have as much good grip on some of the course challenges things. And then when we picked the car that was better, that had less overt, you know, signs, shall we say, or religious things, I saw that it had a different sticker, which the sticker was, it was like a golf sticker or something like that, and it said Pro Grip. And I remembered thinking, and I did very well on that test, and I remember thinking to myself, you pray to God, and then after that, you do the Pro Grip. You hold it, you grab that thing, and you give it the proest, most professional grip you can give it. And,
with your hands or your teeth.
That's it. That's right. That's last week's show. That's right. Last week's show. That's right. Okay. So quite an eventful week here, Rabbi Mike Foyer, in Eretz Yisrael. really a kind of seminal moment, maybe, but certainly a big moment news-wise was the visitation by Vice President of the United States, Mike Pence. And the top thing that happened there was the speech that he gave at the Knesset.
Mm-hmm.
He did the perfunctory things, which I find to be quite a little bit annoying. I'm going to say something seemingly
controversial.
Controversial. I don't. I'm tired of.
Did you get any feedback about the Super Bowl, by the way? Speaking of controversial.
You know what? Great that you reminded me. God, that's another topic for today. That's absolutely right. We'll talk about that in a second.
Okay.
But basically, I actually tweeted out saying, why is it that when important people like President Trump, they go to Saudi Arabia, they do a pumping sword dance, and then when they come here, we have to show them two things: our broken temple by visiting the remnant wall,
right,
and like being all serious and kind of mournful about that. And then, of course, after you saw our sad destroyed temple from 2,000 years ago, how about seeing our sad destroyed Holocaust from 70 years ago? And you go, of course, to Yad Vashem. And I'm like, you know what? That's cool. But can we do a little more, like, take him in a Merkava tank, you know, and have him shoot a target? Yes, Mr. Vice President, push the button. You did it, Vice President Pence. You did it. You just took out ISIS. Bang. Okay. Can we not take him to see some of the Masada, for example? I don't know. Even Masada is like a.
Well, listen. Part of the problem here, aside from the depressive nature of substituting a wall for a
home,
it's
not just depressive. It's also somber.
Somber, depressive. Part of the problem is, and it goes to the root of one of the challenges we face as society, is that to a certain degree, we live off the shadow of the past. You know, like the great generations of building of this country were those that actually shucked off their past, sometimes to their detriment, but they shucked off their past in the belief that a better future awaited them. And there's a real danger in thinking that we can claim legitimacy to our residency in this land by showing people the horrors of the past, even if they're like legitimate historical claims in the temple, etc. What I hear of you saying is that what we need to do is bring people and show them that actually the future is here, not just the past.
Yes, but let me redact a little bit. Not just future. I just mean awesomeness. I just mean rocking.
Well, the future is always more awesome than the past.
I just mean like there's an element which is, all right, do the thing, but you know. Certainly, I'll give you an example of a place that people should visit on a trip. Where should you take people? You should take them to Maat HaMachpelah, see the founders. And without the sad element, like, these are the founders. This is Abraham. You know, Vice President Pence's speech was a lot about Abraham.
Yes.
He talked about Abraham, the man, a lot. And I like that. And by the way, I also felt that for Christian-Jewish dialogue, being able to focus or fixate the conversation more on Abraham certainly makes it more comfortable for us, and I think it deepens it for the conversation for Christian folks. Meaning to say, there is a person that is, you know, the messianic figure in Christianity, but we don't feel comfortable discussing that, okay?
Not only that, but Moses is a problematic figure in the dialogue between us because of the nature of the law. You know, but if you can put your finger on a shared root between Christianity and Judaism, certainly looking to Abraham is a wise place to go. And not just for Christianity and Judaism, not even just for Christianity, Judaism, and Islam, but for a good subset of human culture.
Can you see that maybe Christians could lock into Abraham as being a figure, in a sense, like Uncle Jay? Because for them, he's a man that comes in kind of...
I can't speak for Christians. I can't speak for them. But right. I think that in terms of heroic visionary figures that we can all claim as the originators of the path our separate cultures have taken down through time, absolutely.
Right. And that's more than Isaac and more than Jacob. Jacob is very Israel, the Jewish people.
Yeah, no, Avraham Av Hamon Goyim.
Right, right.
He is the father of many nations. I think it's not a mistake that there's a resonance there. I have a colleague over at Pardes who does a lot of work in conflict resolution around texts of the Abrahamic faiths, of learning to read these texts.
I would like to have a meet at this
colleague. Oh, Rabbi Daniel Roth. Amazing, amazing guy. He's the head of the Center for Conflict Resolution at Pardes. And most of it is in working on how we read our texts.
I would like to use Abraham more in people's consciousness.
Absolutely.
And his stories. Yeah. Vice President Pence came to town, and as I was saying, I wish you would have done something more, you know.
Exciting.
Just a little bit more. Just give him the shtickle, you know, morose stuff, you know. Okay, but then like, take him on a chopper over Jerusalem. I don't know what. Take him to the Temple Mount. Take him to the high-tech places. Show him the chips that are being made. I don't know what. You know,
yeah,
like, I hate to sound like one of these high-tech nation guys, but...
Or personally, I might have given him the time, although he maybe didn't have his schedule. I mean, as a Christian, I'm sure he would have loved to tour the Galilee, right, and see the sites that are important to him.
Okay, but then you get into a whole, you know, then you get into a whole that he's done and he'll do on, but then you get into a whole, like, you'll get in, you know, people will be, you know, are we promoting Christianity, this, whatever.
That stuff just doesn't speak.
I'm just trying to say, can we show the awesomeness of Israel?
Yeah.
Can we show Israel being an awesome, the Saudis, did you see President Trump dancing with the swords? It's like awesome. It's like.
Oh, it was also a little awkward, but that's okay.
It was
they were awesome. He
okay,
was awkward.
Okay, because he's, you know, he's got the white man's overbite. We know about that. That's fine. But like, okay. I'm just saying, Israel, you're also this like.
It's an awesome place.
This awesome, shiny, awesome, you know, powerful thing.
Oh. Speaking of awesome, it's a little bit of a non sequitur, but I went to the Baba Sali's Hilula on Motzei Shabbat.
Yes.
Wait, incredible awesome. I'll give a little context. The Baba Sali was one of the great religious leaders and miracle workers of not our generation, but the previous generation here in the land of Israel. He was the leader, the rabbinic leader of Moroccan Jewry. And he's buried in a small town in the southern Israel called Netivot. And every year, which is the tradition for many people, for many of the righteous, on the date of his death, there's a gathering which is called a Hilula. It's a celebration of his life and his Torah. And as my good friend and Chavruta calls it, it's the big Sephardi party. It's like an incredible cross-section of Israeli society, which is literally like one part party, like music and barbecue and people dancing and singing. And another part, when you get inside where the core is, there's people just crying out to God. It's the most incredible intensity. You have to physically, if you want to even get inside where the grave is, much less actually get close enough to touch it, it's like, the only thing I can compare it to, Lavdil, is a mosh pit. You just have to like worm your way in there and be carried by the crowd with a determination you're going to get the sources. People are crying out and they're screaming, they're praying, they're crying. The awesome energy of it is really something which is a sight to behold.
Well, I'd love to join you next year. I have to admit that I do a lot of these year-round things, but I've never done that. I've never gone to the Baba Sali's Hilula.
It's sweet. It's very sweet.
I'm gonna head out there, Bezrat Hashem, next year, Bli Neder, but with the help of God. Oh, God, please help us get to the amazing places here in the land of Israel.
Amen.
And connect to these things. Please, Hashem, I'd love to want to connect to the Baba Sali. And in fact, there's this wonderful, incredible book about the Baba Sali's Minhagim and his Halachot. It was put out, it was in the Beit Midrash where I lived in Ma'ale HaZeitim and Mount of Olives. Now I don't have that book handy, and it was just awesome, filled with great little stories, tidbits, and halachic, and that's what's so great about these people. You know, it's like a miracle worker and a spiritual, but then there's like, hold the cup this way and do it legally this way and shake the lulav this way.
This is one of the greatnesses of the Torah, that everything emerges from the structure of the law. It's not two separate things. Right? It's an important distinction that the Torah brings into the world, is that commandedness is the primary vehicle for relationship with God, and therefore the precision of action is a tool for power.
And by the way, some people say that the book of Genesis has no commandments. Some people say it has three commandments.
Right, at most.
Which is fruitful, multiply, brit milah, circumcision, and...
Don't eat the sciatic nerve.
That's right. Do not eat the sciatic nerve. Because Uncle Israel, Grandpa Israel, Grandpa Jacob, also known as Israel, you know, was fighting with the angel. And the angel, you know, dislocated his hip and... Therefore, don't eat the sciatic nerve in memory of that.
Sefer Chinuch is an incredible explanation. I mean, be fruitful, multiply, we get. That's like the basic human. Even Freud understood that was the driving force for creation. And the Brit Milah, the covenant of circumcision, is the understanding that humanity was created to be a partner in this incredible drama of creation.
And if you're going to do mitzvah number one...
Well, obviously they have a direct
physical...
You want to do
it through a covenantal...
Right, meaning that the energy of creation was meant to be channeled toward... both procreative and a partnership for really building that which God decided that he couldn't do on his own, right? But number three, this seemingly strange sort of like detail of what we do and don't eat. So the Sefer Chinuch says it's because, how did Jacob get injured in that moment is when he was struggling with Sorrow Shall Asaph, right? This sort of spiritual embodiment of opposition, and he limped out of it. And if you think about it, to a certain degree, we've been limping ever since as a people, but limping forward. And so he says that the act of not eating that portion of the animal is a continual commitment to the belief that the Mashiach will come. That the process may be long and we may end up limping, but that it indeed has an end. And so therefore it fits very much the original impetus of creation, the partnership on which it's really founded, and then the ultimate vision of where we're headed.
I think that's a great answer. I would only add maybe that you may have thought, everybody agrees that there's a globe, a world with humanity and that has to procreate, and, you know, and everybody agrees that we have to purify our thoughts and our bodies. But maybe you might not agree, and this is where Jethro, we'll learn next week's Torah portion, really didn't understand that it would come through a nation.
Mm-hmm.
And there the Torah says to you, yes, there is a specific weird commandment for a weird nation, and it's about the nation.
Yes, and there's children to this day do not eat the sciatic nerve.
Right, the children of Israel.
Right.
Right, it's like an Israel thing. And Israel, and you know what? I believe me, friends and listeners, that I oftentimes say to myself, first thing I ask about why God created the world all the time. I was in IKEA yesterday, and that place makes you question the very existence of this world.
I don't go in there.
First thing, it is just that a human being could conceive of such a thing.
I've never been.
Well, let me tell you, sir, it is a mind blower, really. It's like, I don't know. It's like being inside a computer. It's like Tron, okay?
Tron. You just dated yourself so specifically. It's
okay.
Unbelievable.
All right, you know.
there's like 20 other thousand men like look exactly like you and I out there went, he just said Tron. It's a flood of memories.
Tron's powerful. Anyway, it was like being in Tron. Anyway, my point is just like, look around. I'm like, well, let me get this straight. There's all these animals that have a gigantic brain. They're all walking around this building looking how to make their habitat more pretty. it just weirds me out. I oftentimes look at people, I'm like, why are there these autonomous animals with the spirit brain walking around doing their little thoughts and issues? Why do we even have psychology or economics? Like, where does this all come from? And then I think to myself, why is there an Israel and the Jews? Why are they this thing inside of this whole thing?
Uh-huh.
Anyway, the answer is...
because there is.
That's it.
That's
it. And there is, and you believe it is. For me, it's actually easy. I have an easy time. You know what happens? You know what always assuages or kind of calms that whole questioning line?
What's that?
It's weird. I'm going to say something weird. I just believe that the Torah is written by God, and I mean that not in an intellectual sense.
Mm-hmm.
I just mean to say I just can imagine the words of the Torah immediately, like my questions go away because I believe inside, and like, but I wouldn't call it a belief. I know in my knowledge base that the Torah is written by God, and that's what always like
brings you back to center.
Yeah.
For me, it's history. For me, it's absolutely history. Our journey through time. I was sitting with a student yesterday who was asking me about some of the more obscure commandments in the Torah, like not mixing wool and linen or not cutting the corners of your hair.
Right.
And on some level, what I said to her was, well, you know what? These things are just who we are. I mean, we could get into theology. We could get into deconstruction of the text and how to. I said, but the simplest answer is, well, this is who we are. And if you want to be who we are, then this is what we do. And if you don't, then on some level...
I thought you were going to say the proof of the greatest proof of God's existence and that the Torah is real is the existence of the Jewish people as an
historical entity.
Right.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's a more sophisticated explanation. I was just trying to like sort of bring things down to tachlis. Like sometimes looking for the intellectual and spiritual justifications is a mistake because the Torah is meant to be lived and not justified.
Very good. Very good. Speaking of bringing things down to tachlis, before we go on to the Torah portion, which is chock full of important things, real foundational ones. Let us introduce a new partner for the show, a new what did you call it before?
Sponsor.
A new sponsor for the show, and that is an amazing new company called North Israel Property Investment. And what this is about, first thing, it's our good friend Shmuel.
Nippy.
And his, what's that?
Nippy.
Nippy? Yes.
We're going to talk about that.
NIPI. Okay. Yes, North Israel Property Investment. And this is so cool because so many of you want to purchase property in the land of Israel, but you have heard that it is super expensive. Well, guess what? One of the most beautiful parts of the land of Israel is still just being in development. You can get amazing deals, amazing views, amazing communities, amazing investment in the land of Israel, but it's in the northern Israel, such beautiful towns as Carmel and Tveri and Tzfat and the Golan Heights and Haifa, the north. The north is amazing. And now I have teamed up together with North Israel Property Investment. And if you go to their website, which is northisrael.com/Yishai. If you go to northisrael.com/Yishai, check this out. This is, we've been working on this, okay? Sign up and you get an email with the top reasons to own property in North Israel. And as a friend of Yishai, get 15-minute complimentary consultation on making your dream of owning your own property in North Israel a reality. And this is the best part. If you go to this website, this page, northisrael.com/Yishai, you will get lunch in the north on North Israel. They will take you out to shawarma or a burger and fries.
Plane ticket not included.
Plane ticket not included, not even the bus ticket included or car rental. But when you get up to the north, you will be treated to an amazing lunch. First thing, you'll be so thankful to God, to everything, Land of Israel Network, to the whole thing. You'll be like, I can't believe it. This is such an opportunity. And you're going to own beautiful property in the end, and you're going to have free lunch.
Woo-hoo. Free? Wait, I thought there wasn't a free lunch.
No, there is a free lunch. That's exactly what it is. That's right. You will have free lunch up there, which I think is amazing. And you're only going to get it through this one portal. That's it. It's the northisrael.com/Yishai, and I'm very excited about it on so many levels. I want you to have that shawarma in Carmel. I want you to have that shawarma in Carmel. And I definitely, you know, one of my standard pitches to people, I'm like, are you making Aliyah? No. Okay. Are you buying property in the land of Israel? You know, and not, are you coming to vacation in the land of Israel? Are you sending your kids to Israel? I mean, there's always many levels of connectivity.
And here's your vehicle.
Here's your vehicle. And this one is going to also, you're going to thank me because this isn't just cost money. It's going to give you a free lunch, but also it's going to get you huge investment in your return at the end. It's all going up, folks. The property in the land of Israel is going up.
Yes, get in now.
That's right. Get in now. It's one of these things. This ain't no Bitcoin, okay? This is solid, okay? This is solid stuff. There's nothing more solid. And it's the, if you're listening up to this part of the show, unless you're like a Yishai hater looking for a Rabbi Mike or Yishai hater looking for some way to find
catch us
saying something horrible. But most of you, 99% of you who are listening to this part of the show, you already agree with this ideology. Now make your ideology a reality. Make your dream come true. Okay. So that's northisrael.com/Yishai. Okay, very cool. And lunch is on us. All right, that's neat, right?
Yeah.
Is that fun?
Can I get it for your lunch?
If you want.
Oh,
I don't know.
We'll talk about that
later. I think you're Nagua Badover.
Yeah, that's right. Excluding all members of the institution.
That's right. All right, let's get to the Torah portion. We have a lot to talk about. Okay, so our Torah portion is Beshalach. And it is in the book of Exodus, Movement of Ja-People, chapter 15, and Beshalach.
Well, it goes all the way back to 14, but.
Oh, it goes to 14. Sorry about that. I was on the wrong page there. And this is, remember the name of the book, Exodus. This is it. We're going to Exodus right now.
We're moving.
This is Movement of Ja-People. This is it. Okay, Exodus, come on. All right, this is what's happening. The Jews are being sent out of Egypt, and God's taken them out of Egypt. So they're being sent out of Egypt. God has taken them out of Egypt, also leaving Egypt. All those things are true, right? The whole thing is coming together, as we always talk about. First thing I want to stop here and just mention the fact that it says that Moses took the bones of Joseph. Okay, why? Because he made them swear. It says, Vikach Moshe Tatzmot Yosef. Moses took the bones of Joseph, Imo, with him. And by the way, maybe you could say also Amo, his nation. You could read it a different way. Like there's a nation, there's a togetherness. Ki Hishbea Hishbea, because Joseph made them take an oath. Who? Et Bnei Israel. They made the oath saying, Pakod Yifkod Elohim Etchem. God is going to
recall. He's going to both recall and command
you, and he's going to
basically put you in the right place to do the right thing.
Right, but
that's why it's also tafkid.
Right, that's tafkid. That's right. It means like a. I always tell people one of my little aliyah lines. I'm like, I don't know if you're gonna have a job in Israel, but you definitely have a tafkid. Right. Pakod yifkod Elohim etchem ve'alitem et atzmotai mizeh itchem. Take out my bones from this place with you. So Joseph, who kind of stayed behind, the righteous man who stayed behind, his bones are being taken out. There's a lot of midrashim about this, that basically Joseph's bones were buried underneath the Nile to bless the Nile. They indeed did turn him into a kind of god or a demigod. Or,
and also to hide them in order that the children of Israel couldn't leave.
Right. And then Moshe basically wrote on a metal plate, engraved into a metal plate, saying "Aleh Shor," rise up, bull, because that's his moniker, right? And his bones rose up. That little metal plate will be important later on.
It's going to cause some problems later.
It's going to cause problems later. Stay tuned for that. And they're taking the bones of Joseph with them. They're going, and he brought them down there. And he's the last to kind of come out. He's close. First in, last out. Like, it's a Marine thing.
Yeah, it is. And we've spoken about this at length, and considering what lies ahead of us, maybe we don't want to go too far. But the image to me is very important because Moses, of course, was the man of the future at this point. He's leading toward where they need to go. And he understood that if you want to reach your future, you have to bring your past with you, that you can't leave it behind.
That's right.
And it's one of the most important things that we as a people really need to think about today. Because as I mentioned earlier, in my opinion, there's too much of the Zionist momentum that was about abandoning the past. Right? Whereas today, our national vision, I believe, needs to be like bring our past with us into the future that we dream of.
Right.
And Moses is our example.
That's what
here.
He's doing. He's taking the past.
Literally.
Walking it with the future, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah. And it's also, it's interesting the bones of Joseph, the bones. There's Joseph the man who did stuff. I remember him. No, you got to take the bones with you. The building blocks.
Yeah.
The stuff that of the exile, the stuff of all that. And also I think that when you come to the land of Israel with your pekala, with your baggage, you bring a lot with you, especially American Jewry, North American Jewry, or whatever. People from all over the world, like, you bring your culture with you, adds so much to this beautiful, complex thing.
I mean, it speaks to me so much in terms of how I reacted to the notion of bringing Vice President Pence to Yad Vashem, which is that, you know, they bury Yosef's bones in the land of Israel.
In Shechem.
Because the only way to properly deal with the difficulties that you carry in your past is to bury it in where you're headed for the future. And that's one of these real challenges that we have here right now, is that we are not at the stage as a people to be able to process the last 2,000 years of suffering culminating in the Holocaust. We're unable to grasp. We haven't buried the past in a healthy fashion. We're picking away at it in a way which I find to be problematic at best.
And even the bones of Joseph's themselves are in trouble.
Well, yeah. Well,
it's related. It's related.
Yes, I think so. I think it is.
It's related. But we have talked about this in the past, and we are going to keep going. I am fascinated by the story of the bones of Joseph. It's really important
piece for you.
Yeah, it's an amazing thing for me that they just, and then they're going to carry these bones. And in fact, I think I saw, I don't remember if it was a Gemara, but I did see that there was this idea that there was two Aron Kodesh in the desert. One of them was the Torah ark. The other one was the bones of Joseph ark.
Hmm.
And even in this week's Torah portion, there's like a hidden story in here where the sea, we're going to get to the sea splitting in just a few minutes, but that sea would not split until they brought the bones of Joseph to the sea. And the sea said, I shall retreat from he who retreated. He, Joseph, that retreated from the wife of Potiphar, was able to overcome his nature. So too I shall overcome my nature. And it was until basically the knock-knock on the door of the sea by Joseph, the one who came down to Egypt and really brought everybody down. It was to say, we're leaving now.
Yep.
It's time for us to go.
Story's moving forward.
Okay, now we're going to talk about two originals. The original yin-yang is in this week's Torah portion. That's right. The original yin-yang.
I think that the Chinese might dispute you on that.
Well, or they might be like, we honor your tradition.
Okay.
Or maybe, you know, we're... By the way, There's a new thing happening in this world, which is interesting, which is the relationship of ancient peoples. I'm seeing this starting to rise up. China, India, Israel, Persia.
Iran, yeah.
You know, right. there's this covenant of ancient peoples coming along, and I think we could sew
that
together.
We can work with that stuff.
In any case, the original yin yang is in this week's Torah portion. Why? It says that God walked before the children of Israel as they were leaving Egypt during the day with a pillar of cloud, and at night with a pillar of fire. See it? The pillar of cloud, pillar of fire, the little dots, right, of the yin-yang, right? You have it's daytime, so there's a little darkness. It's nighttime, so there's a little light, right? You see that?
Yeah.
You see that? That's the way God leads us. He, like, in the opposite thing that you need at that time, there's a little point of that. When you're in day, remember a shtickle night. When you're at night, remember a shtickle day.
It's built into the way we declare the unity of God. Is that one of the key blessings that approaches what we call Kriyat Shema, the declaration of the unity, is recalling the day during the night and the night during the day. It's because the world is only one thing. Even though we experience that as a struggle of forces and often opposites, right? We are very committed to the notion that it all has one source.
Right. What about yin-yang? Do you know anything about that?
I don't really go there.
A little bit. Come on, give me a little.
I
love Asian stuff.
Oh, well, then let's get an Asian on and let them talk about their own culture. I'm very adverse to hypothesizing about other people's culture.
But I love sushi.
Okay.
Why do Jews love sushi? By the way, interestingly enough, did you notice that in America, Jews love Chinese food so much? Here, we don't have Chinese food anymore.
No, we've got great sushi, though.
But we're nuts about sushi.
Even in Malaya Dumim.
Of course.
Yeah.
In the Gush, forget about it. Yeah. There's a guy in Efrat who makes his whole, he wakes up in the morning, all he does is he makes sushi, drives it around town, and he's making buko bucks. Okay.
Very nice. All right, moving on.
All right. So we have the Jewish people are heading out, and guess what? Those very British, oh, I meant Egyptian, that just a second ago wanted to give us a state and wanted to give us Exodus, suddenly they're the ones that are turning around trying to stop us.
They didn't really want to give it in the first place.
But they agreed, you know.
Well, okay.
They acceded to it.
That's what happens when things are about a constellation of power. You agree until you don't.
Right, okay. So that's fine. That's a good point. And here they come. Dun, 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 dun. They're coming. They're coming, right? They're charged, right? They're coming at you with all their chariots and horses.
The whole
shebang, they're after you. I feel that way in Hebron sometimes.
Yeah,
I feel like the whole world is trying to, you know, recently we had an anti-Hebron article in the New York Times. And in the Forward, they keep publishing one of the big enemies of Hebron. He's one of their star writers. Mm-hmm. And you're like they're after us. They really want to wipe this thing out.
Oh, they do.
They really, really do. And here comes Pharaoh with all of his chariots. And here's my favorite. This is the original. And we talked about this last year, right? This is the original Jewish humor moment.
Right.
That's right. Jewish cynical humor. All of the Seinfelds and all the Woody Allens and who else? And what's his name? The guy, not Rodney Dangerfield.
I know you're thinking of.
Who's the guy who played Krusty the Clown?
It'll come to us in the middle of the show. I'm not going to break my brain.
Right. Anyway, all Jewish humor all stems from the original pasuk, which says the following. Vayomru el Moshe, and the people said to Moses, Hamibli ink varim b'mitzrayim. There are no graves in Egypt.
You had to take us all the way out here to die.
Why do you have to take us here? We could have just died there. Right. It would have been fine just to work them. Wouldn't have been better there.
Would have been quicker. I wouldn't have these corns on my feet.
This is good.
Right.
Great. This is a good place to be buried. Anyway, but the great line, this is an actual line in Torah. Are there no graves in Egypt? And what do you think the look on Moshe's face is in that moment, right? Consternation? Probably.
I mean, he's got a lot of...
But is there maybe...
He's got this question. This is not the last time he's going to hear this question.
Right, but was there a little ironic smile? Was there a little Jewish humor? Was there an old man with some schnapps and herring who said, what, there were no graves in Egypt?
At least in potentia, if not in actuality.
Right, I feel like there was a minion in the morning.
I don't know, but when I hear this, I just like really feel for Moshe Rabbeinu, because this is only the first time he's going to hear this question. Every time something goes wrong in the desert, it's going to be this same question, which you hear the childishness You know, you hear the childishness in the children of Israel. It's just, well, I'm just gonna die. We should just die. Let's just die. You know.
Well, the eternal people have got the only thing that destroys the eternal people is some kind of self-destructive bug.
Yes, the wish for death.
Right. There's something in our people which there's only one thing, which it's only one kryptonite to this people, and that is itself.
Well, it's not surprising because, you know, the eternal people, as you said, and the people whose destiny is really to be a vehicle for redemption, it's a lot of work. It's a lot of work. This is not, like, even when we get to the land of Israel here, it's not like the land of milk and honey is going to be a cakewalk.
No. Remember, it's like, I'll take you to the land of milk and honey, the land of the Canaanites, the Perizzites,
right.
The Hittites.
Right. The two come hand in hand.
Right.
And so at a certain point, and I hear this, I mean, I've heard this from many students and friends, it's like, can we just be normal? Can we just do our thing and fade into the sunset like everyone else? And the answer, of course, is no.
But
no,
you do try to do that. And I'm going to say something. Really, I don't want to hurt anybody's feelings. But sometimes I feel like Florida is Jews, a lot of them Holocaust survivor Jews, who just like...
Enough.
Yeah. And sometimes I feel like they deserve it.
Well, listen, I mean, like survivors exist in a category unto themselves.
Right. Right. You know? But that is that category. Isn't it kind of just an extreme form of what you're talking about?
Well, no, I don't think so. Because someone who actually survived... The Holocaust, I think, really exists in a different category. Those who live in the shadow of it.
But aren't the Jewish people people who have survived a continuous type of Holocaust, including this Egyptian one?
Yes, but the very big difference. There's a very big difference between myself and, say, my great aunt, who actually went through both gates of Auschwitz.
Right.
You know, so meaning I agree with you, and there's a deep challenge. And it's heartbreaking how much that plays a role in this country, in our fair country.
Our beloved country.
Our beloved fair country. Right. How much people want to just live a normal life, which I understand. I understand it. But people wake up. It's not meant to be. And insofar as we have that sort of very sort of passive desire to slip off the page of history, habe shlichem l'makom, right? God has many agents to keep us on the path to move toward redemption, and not all of them are pleasant.
Still, though, sometimes eating a shawarma or playing ultimate frisbee like I played last night is a key way to keep that energy going.
I want to make it fresh, keep it young. I want
to
make a distinction between enjoying life and engaging in the fullness of human experience and trying to just fade into the sunset. I think that real enjoyment and real full, especially bodily engagement here in the land of Israel, is a very important and somewhat new phenomenon for the Jewish people, at least in the last 2,000 years. I don't see that as I just want to like fun in the sun and that's an important part of life, but it needs to be as a refreshing and a deep engagement in order to stay on mission.
Okay, so we definitely need that engagement, but right now the Jewish people are not in that moment of engagement.
Listen, we're between a hot rock and a hard place.
Yeah, literally between Pharaoh's armies,
the devil in the deep blue sea.
Right, that's right, and really, and if you've ever been to the Red Sea, it is indeed a deep, deep sea.
Yes, it is.
It's a very deep sea.
Well, it's because it's a continental rift, but we don't have to get into the geology of it.
Yeah, but like when you swim out over that thing, you swim out about 20 meters out, suddenly there's a kilometer drop off.
Oh, yes.
I get seized up. My breathing gets seized up.
It's pretty scary.
I can swim out there and then and also the knowledge that there are deep creatures there and stuff like that. It's a scary sea.
Yeah,
it is a scary sea, and I could see them walking down that drop off somehow and coming back up. If you've ever been to the Red Sea, it's very visual like that. In any case, so the Jewish people are flipping out. They're doing various things. Some are praying. Some want to fight. Some want to commit suicide.
Some want to just go home, back to Egypt.
Some want to go back to slavery. But God said the Moses says to the people, he calms them down. He's like, everybody relax. God is with us. Then he turns to God. He's like, God, what's going on? God's like, he says to him, Mati Tzakalai, why are you yelling to me? Don't yell at me. Don't yell at me. Don't even turn to me. Don't pray to me. Tell the children of Israel to go. Just go. Just go. Now, Rabbi Tendler says, and I say this every year, Rabbi Tendler, Rabbi Moshe David Tendler from Muncie, New York, who I just saw here in Eretz Yisrael, he always says about this verse is that what God is actually saying to the question is, what does it mean? Just stop praying. We Jewish people pray when we're in a bad situation. God says to him, you got the whole Jewish people together. That's the most powerful force in the world. It could split the Red Sea. It could do anything. Just go.
Move with it.
Just go. You don't have to do anything.
There's another message that I see in this, which is that from Avraham, we've encountered several times, and there's no reason to detail them all, but we'll see them throughout Jewish history, the situations in which our understanding is inadequate to match our experience. Right? Let's just stick with our example. Here's Am Yisrael. They've just had seen 10 plagues. They're following a pillar of fire at night and cloud by day, and they've come up against the impassable. And they don't understand. They say, well, I don't get it. Like, the plan was to leave Egypt, and here we are now at an absolutely unnegotiable impasse. And they try to figure it out. Everyone comes up with their plan, and we got to fight, and we got to go back, and we got to surrender, we got to do whatever we do. And God says, no. What you need to do right now is move forward. Because the ability, think back to Avram, when God said to him, listen, Yitzchak, he's your future. And by the way, now I want you to take him and sacrifice him. Avram didn't freeze up. He didn't understand how that was going to work. But he took his experience of God's voice and moved forward. And what came from that was a great covenant. And here, this is what God is saying. Now, this is the key to understand, is that when your experience is driving you away that your understanding doesn't match, you need to keep moving forward. And it's so critical for our people today here in our country and our people, our brothers and sisters in America and wherever else they may be in the world listening, to understand all the conceptual frameworks and all the negotiations and the arguments we're having as a people are all very important and they're all very, very good. But don't lose focus. The most important thing to do right now is move forward. Right? We move forward with our vision of building ourselves as a people and our land and a nation that can really light the world, and the sea will split.
I think what you're saying is very, very deep and very true, and I feel that all the time in just life. I think what you're saying right now about just moving forward is like, it's one of the truer things. It's just true, and it's certainly true about Israel. And I, as a person who listens to the news and analyzes the news, I also slough off
a lot of it.
I just don't even pay attention because I realize that this is so today's little arguments.
Yes, well, that's what they fit to wrap fish, as they used to say.
Right, and it's like this is not important. The big picture is, and it is yet mysterious, and yet it's destinous. I'm going to use a creative word here. I mean, say it's often our future, and we're marching towards that, and nothing will stop it. We just got to keep marching forward.
And it's our fear that wants to shrink the world to the size in which we understand it.
I find that some of the liberal tendencies today are in that. They're in this zone where they're very locked into this fight or this fight and you know, this problem at the Kotel or this problem with the speech and pitchefkes or what they used to call in the 60s petty tyrants.
Right.
You know, like little things that are locking people's minds into minute arguments. And I also find that that is the mindset in America in general. Endless spats.
And it's not that they're not important, these questions. It's just that they're many of them irreconcilable, and others they're not the main line. But I think there's another problem that the liberal world faces, and we've spoken about this before, which is how certainty has gained such a bad name. And you can't move forward if you're not certain, at least certain about the fact that you should move forward. And by the way, lest somebody's thinking right now, but how do you know which way to move? I got news for you. One of the most important lessons I ever learned in the wake of my father's death and the breakdown and confusion that I really experienced afterwards was a very simple metaphor that changed my life, which, you know, you can't actually steer a bike until it's moving.
Right.
That sometimes in life, actually, the answer is move forward. Right. And even if you end up moving forward and deciding, oh, I'm going in the wrong direction, I'm going to turn around, at least you're moving.
Right.
Right. In the sense that you have to figure everything out and then move is a myth because it's premised on the idea that you could figure everything out. Like I said, it's fear that makes us want to shrink the world to the dimensions that we can comprehend. And by the way, that by definition excludes God. You know what happens here at the sea? Right. What does the Midrash say when the sea split? What happened all over the world?
The water split.
Every drop of water in the world split, which is like one of those midrashic statements that people, especially my students, like to just say, oh, those silly rabbis, right? But you have to understand the depth of what they're saying. There were four camps at the sea here. Fight, run, pray, die. None of them said...
But by the way, parenthetically, when that sounds weird to you, die, remember that Gandhi, his recommendation for the Jewish people during the Holocaust was mass suicide in order to prove what kind of point.
By the way, that's a bit of a misstatement what he said. I can show it to you in writing, but we can discuss that some other time.
I think it was like be willing to die, not like.
Oh yes, yeah. Well that's what I'm saying. Right. Being willing to die was a core element of his philosophy.
Right.
I don't want to argue about Gandhi right now.
Okay. No, but I mean to say that it's not a legitimate option.
Right. No, it's a legitimate option. Dying for what you believe in is certainly something that Jewish people have never been afraid of.
Right.
Living for what you believe in is actually what we're about.
That's right.
But there was a fifth option that nobody thought of. And you know what that was? Hey, let's just move forward into the sea and it'll split. Why did nobody think of it? Because it was outside of our comprehension. But you know what's fascinating? As soon as Nachshon ben Aminadav made that move up to his nostrils and the sea split, from that moment on, we existed in a whole new world. Imagine history repeats itself, and the Jewish people are standing at the Red Sea once again 2,000 years from now. Sound familiar? And there are four camps. Run, fight, surrender, die. But now there's a fifth camp. What's the fifth camp say?
Just go.
Well, the fifth camp says, let's split the sea. Right. But actually, there's a sixth camp as well, which is, gosh, you have no idea what could happen right now. And that's what I believe the sages meant when they said that every drop of water in the world split, is that this was a watershed for the Jewish people's understanding of creation. It's not just, oh, next time we could split the sea. It's that don't reduce the world to your understanding out of your fear. Move forward and God will provide. And from then on out, this defines the successful path of Jewish people. Oh, you're going to fight the world's strongest empires? Oh, you're not going to accept the global peace? You're not all these things that the Jews keep saying, well, yeah, but no, we're going this way. And look here where we are.
There are movements today that are trying very hard. There is movement. There is movement right now.
Yes, absolutely.
And there is a policy movement, which I must say I really felt was going to happen with the Trump ascendancy. And I was hoping for it, frankly. And I am actually quite gratified so far at some of the incredible moves that have been made. The beginnings of the recognition of Jerusalem, the movement now on the embassy, the leaving of UNESCO, the beginnings of the defunding of UNRWA. Hopefully that'll lead to more defunding of this whole thing. And basically calling the bluff of the whole... the world should pay for your corruption, for your jihad, for your war against Israel, your absolute recalcitrance at ever trying to come to any kind of detente.
You know what the next move is, and I really would love to see this happen. Is now we have to convince Trump and America behind him to build. Because the fallacy of all the pieces that you identified there is that they're built not only on lies, but they're built on the disempowerment, particularly of the Palestinian Arabs. Like UNRWA, the idea of keeping people as perpetual refugees as a tool in the struggle against us is like the deepest cruelty I could imagine. Right? What this region needs is a Marshall Plan. It needs someone with a vision to rebuild in a way in which would actually put it as the jewel of the world that it could be.
You've said this before, and it's a beautiful thought. There's just one little nick in that thought.
The war that has to precede it?
Well, you have to have a ready and willing people that want to build and be creative. The Europeans, if anything, have always been people who have wanted to build a life and
listen, I'm going to tell you that there have been plenty of phases in Arab history where they've built amazing, amazing societies. And
Arab or Muslim?
Both. Both, actually.
Yeah.
And one of the challenges here is that we're in the post-colonial era, and very few people are willing to own that, except in sort of like gucky academic speech that plays into other problems that I don't want to get into right now. Like, part of what needs to happen right now is a bit of an owning of how we got in this situation, and then a letting go of it and saying, okay, great, but what kind of life do I actually want to have?
Yeah. I maybe I don't have the exact right words for it, but I think kind of when you see it. There is a unwillingness to embrace what you're talking about yet.
But I think as long as
there's a maturation process that has to happen.
Nurse off the teat of the refugee dollars, then you'll never see any change.
Yeah, but it's not just the local Palestinians. It's or Arabs. Here it's we're talking about a global movement which. It's, in a sense, unapologetic or is unable to see its own flaws and really wants to swallow up the world in a kind of darkness. It's just not there right now. It needs a certain humbling. Like, don't forget that the Marshall Plan comes after...
The occupation.
And a major humbling of...
I hate to speak about war in anything other than terrible terms. But if this is not done, then all the rounds of fighting we've seen up to now are going to pale in comparison to the conflict that's coming. I mean, I don't have to tell you what's surrounding us at this point, and more so every day. And we as a people, thank God, are done with being lambs to the slaughter.
I kind of agree with you, but on the other hand, I also turn to my Arab colleagues often. I say to them, look around your world. It's built on quicksand.
It's crumbling.
It's like I don't even think we have such a big conflict ahead, except for Iran. That's the big one. We'll talk about that. It's a separate thing, but that's not Arab. That's the
Muslim.
Persian world, the Muslim world, and it's a certain kind of Muslim. It's a mix of a certain kind of Muslim extremism with a certain kind of Persian extremism together. But in any case, my point to you is that I don't really even see such a big conflict with the Arabs. In some sense, it's just like wait them out because the trajectories are so the opposite direction. I don't think we're going to have a big conflict with the Arabs. I just think that they're imploding right before our eyes. To me, it's just like Israel's trajectory is flying, you know, into the stratosphere economically, culturally, globally, and the Arab world is sinking at an unbelievable rate, really, and destroying its own gems. Its own cultural gems. For example, Aleppo. I don't think anybody understands what happened there. One of the most ancient.
And I've seen some of the footage. It's horrific.
And what was the name of the city?
Palmyra.
You know, it's just. I don't see them. They're lacking in atmosphere and oxygen. It's almost like the whole thing is
maybe
working
it's the
on
conflict
kind of
with Iran that's going to open it up. But I see the way forward, and I think that actually Trump, with all the flaws, and you know, I'm not a huge fan. At least he knows how to think big, and that's what the smallness, like you were identifying, the sort of like petty pieces that people get hung up on. I think there's a potential there to sell him on a vision of really rebuilding, like right. Let's move out of refugee and crisis post-colonial mode and think about like the world we actually want to live in.
Well, the first thing in my opinion, the first way to build forward is to have a bigger Israel. A bigger Israel is a better force here in this region. I think Israel is not in its...
Listen, that for us is going to have to come at the cost of figuring out within ourselves how do we really relate to the non-Jewish world.
Right.
There's a deep level
or
of work.
Or to the non-Jews within us.
Both. I mean, within us is a more pressing issue, but it's both. And there's like some very deep work that needs to be done there of how we can really hold ourselves as the people we know ourselves to be. And how we can hold both justice and security, how we can hold our vision of redemption and not sort of shallow visions of peace.
So what you're saying is that certain lies that we've really gotten used to living with.
That we've internalized. Even.
And that we've internalized or even created.
Yeah.
But certainly have allowed ourselves to live with. Like we all know that UNRWA creates an Arab refugee class that doesn't even necessarily exist. And we all know that UNESCO is a memory historical robber, right? And yet somehow suddenly, and I remember this. This reminds me also again back to New York of a little bit of Rudy Giuliani, who like came in and was just like, no, I will clean it up, and like whoop, it actually changed.
It worked.
Like there's something happening in the world right now, and there's certain, as we say in Hebrew, muskamot, certain accepted
agreed upon conclusions,
right? Narratives inner beliefs that are being shattered.
Yep.
Another thing was shattered is like I think Israelis were absolutely dumbfounded when they heard the actual speech made by Vice President Pence. They
were just like, that's because the Vice President is a believer in God,
right?
And
he's a world leader getting up on. By the way, Ben Bresky, I want to thank Ben Bresky for editing the show, and my man Moshe Herman for getting the show out there, and Tabitha as well from the network. But Ben Bresky says to me, he says, you know, there are articles that are saying, what does it even matter? It's just a vice president. He doesn't have any power or something. I'm like, that is the stupidest thing I've ever heard in my life.
He's the representative of the most powerful country in the world.
Right.
And by the way, as far as I can tell, between he and the president, he holds a real voice.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So yeah, there was a Bible believing man up there.
And actually even more important, which is I hear from you, is he also represents a world culture.
Right.
Right, which deserves, and I like, you know, have my own historical issues with Christianity, but the world, and particularly the Islamic world, I think needs to wake up and look at the process of self-awareness and reorientation that Christianity has undergone in the last 100
parts of Christianity.
Okay, parts of Christianity, fair enough. But you know what? Listen, you can't have it all.
But I just want to make sure we understand that, because sometimes Israelis also get very confused about that.
Yes.
They're like, Christians love Israel. I'm like, take it easy. Okay. Take it easy. I've seen NGO Monitor showed me a study of the monies that are coming into anti-Israel organizations. Half of that money comes through Christian organizations in Europe. Now, I just want to make sure that we understand that.
Fair enough.
We're talking about a large, important, powerful
segment.
But
my point was less about the money or the absolute. My point was is how a people is able to re-engage their own faith and find a way to move forward and not become stuck in their past, and not have to abandon their faith in order to do it. So we as a people have also been undergoing that process in our return to our home, which is not a simple thing in the light of the last 2,000 years. And we're waiting for Islam.
All right. It's time for us to shift back into the Torah
back
portion.
To the Torah?
We got to hit this because what's going to happen is that there is going to be a splitting of the Red Sea.
Absolutely.
It's splitting
if
of the
you
Red
haven't
sea.
Heard, it's big news.
It's big news. You saw it in the movies in various formats. And I think, by the way, that's what it means when it says that the sea split everywhere.
Eventually everybody's going to know?
Yeah, it came into everybody's mind. Like, everybody was affected by this.
Even in the Bible we see when the first venture into the land of Israel, when Joshua sends the spies and they stay in Rahab's inn, she says, well, we all heard how God split the sea.
Right, and we continue to hear about it.
Yeah.
We continue to hear about it.
We're still making movies.
Right, we're still talking about it, and it's still, and we're still splitting things.
Yeah, well.
We're still splitting the atom, you know?
Right, right now we're trying to put them together. Actually.
Right, okay. What's it called? 3D printing and all that. But my point to you is that this thing touched the whole world, and here we go. Let's get into the sea. The sea splits, folks, and that sea splits, by the way, is not just, here's an interesting point, here's an interesting correlation. Think of the state of Israel. Do you think of it as only a refuge? Or is it something more? The splitting of the Red Sea was a refuge from the Egyptian army, etc.
Sure. Escape route.
But inside, the average person experienced prophecy to the highest levels.
That's
meaning that it itself is a spiritual moment.
Yes.
Not just a fleeing.
Yes, absolutely.
Right?
It's critical.
A revelatory moment.
It was a revelation on the level of Sinai. It was a revelation on the level of Sinai. In many ways, paved the way for our ability to receive the Torah, not just in a sort of logistical, oh, got to get out of Egypt sense.
It is the birth canal, right? We talked about birth canal last week, but like birth canal of a nation.
Yep.
The sea gave birth to a nation.
Well, Egypt was the womb.
Egypt was the womb.
Egypt was the womb. We were nurtured in the most powerful physical, material culture in the world. We were birthed out with great suffering.
Right.
But what's critical is we were birthed out into the wilderness, right? And we'll talk about Sinai in the weeks to come, but it's very important to remember that in the ancient world, like that triad of blood, God, and land was what defined peoplehood, right? But we as a people were born elsewhere. We were birthed out into nowhere, and what made us a people was receiving the Torah together.
Right. Is that what made us a people?
Yes. That's why the rabbis said we all converted at Sinai.
Right. See, I'll challenge what you said, or think about it in a different way, which is, as a people, we were born in the Red Sea, but as a spirit, as a spiritual force, as a conduit of God's message, I want to split between peoplehood and religiousahood.
I think religion is a very late comer to who we are.
Religion. You know what I'm talking about. I'm talking about here.
The Torah is a vessel that holds us together in the same way as the land is a vessel that holds us together.
Right. But in a different way.
The primary.
Sure. I'm going to say it's the primary, but I'm just saying the child was born, the physical child was born in the Red Sea. And the spirit of the child, the child's about, comes down in Sinai. It's like a different stage. Like some people compare Sinai to a chuppah.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Not some people, some of our sources. Or like a bar mitzvah, whatever it is, but a coming of age when you actually take upon yourself the commandments. So there's a difference between the physical body of Israel, the people of Israel, because there's an Israel without Torah. Is there an Israel without Torah?
Speaking of that, this week,
one of our ministers, Victor Lieberman, pushed hard against the one of the laws that's trying to be that got passed and is trying to be promulgated, which closes down these supermarkets in the small towns. And he basically went to one of these supermarkets on Shabbat, drove down there, right. went to a, like a non-kosher supermarket and like purchased something there. And he keeps on saying, "I'm all for Shabbat.
Don't tell me what to do with it.
Right? Just don't." Well, don't coerce. Don't coerce. Don't make it into law.
Right.
Make it into a cultural thing that we all want to join, freely, mm-hmm. as opposed to being forced into it by your secular state laws. And I think I can at least understand where he's coming from.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I understand it both from a tactical standpoint, and I also understand it from a spiritual standpoint. But we're 3,000 plus years down the road from here. From crossing the Red Sea, and actually, I'm challenged by the notion of an Israel without Torah. And now I think that what Torah is deserves a much broader discussion.
Right.
And it's certainly more than law, and it's certainly more than a book.
Right.
But
it does say that the reason I blessed Abraham was because he would teach the laws to the sons, and he would keep my statutes.
In many ways, I believe that we as a people are the embodiment of what Torah is.
Right. Of course, I agree with those things, and you know that. You know, there would
no,
have been
here's the challenge. There's something
but
unique
I also think
about
that it's important.
The splitting of the Red Sea and the crossing.
Right. There's also something important to know that there's an ethnic group called the Jews. Understand that, and that's God. Just like God has different names, so too does Israel have different names. The Hebrew people are an entity, an ethnic entity, a children, a tribe.
We are people, but the ethnic, I mean, we're a tribal people. You walk the streets of Jerusalem as much as I.
Yes.
I mean, you look at the faces of the people that call themselves Am Yisrael, and there's a beautiful diversity to it.
Sure.
Right? And to call that ethnic, I think, is a misnomer.
Well, we are genetically linked. We have a bloodline, mostly.
Many of us.
Most of us.
Many of us.
That's how we're mostly Jewish, is through a legal means by which we actually stay within a tribe. You know what it is I'm trying to say? I'm just trying to say there's an aspect to it, and
yeah.
that is also an aspect. It's an aspect. I agree with you about the supremacy and the whole kit and caboodles for the Torah.
How much genetics do I share with my Ethiopian neighbor? Like, frankly, genetically.
I think quite a bit.
But we dive in together. We
right.
worship the same God. We come home to the same country. You know.
But I think both of those are true. Meaning to say, it's because we have an ethnic relationship. Not because. It is we have an ethnic relationship. We have a spiritual relationship. We have a destiny relationship.
This deserves further discussion because
okay.
I think that we're using terms that we may not agree on their definitions. And that prevents us from understanding.
Okay. Very good. Okay. But Okay. I hope that our listeners understand the complexity of this issue. And by the way, I want to hear from you folks. I want to hear from you. Write me an email, yeshai@thelandofisrael.com, ravmike@thelandofisrael.com. We love to hear from you. I want you to come up with good hashtags for the issues that we discussed on the show today. If you think of a hashtag for some of these issues, just send it to me. I got to think of something to.
What are you gonna do with it?
I love when
you
they send
giveaways.
The hashtag. Oh, you know what? That reminds me about the Super Bowl. So I did get an email about my Super Bowl challenge. My Super Bowl challenge, of course, is don't watch it.
Right, it's
skip
very different
it.
Than the standard Super Bowl challenge.
Right, skip it. Skip it altogether and just breathe free and clear that I didn't.
Your quote was slay the foreign god.
That's
actually.
Right, slay the foreign gods. Just really just say no to this thing and instead supplant it with something meaningful. So writes Judah, okay? Judah writes, he says, and he's the only email I got back on this. I could feel a lot of people were just like, oh.
I
don't
want to go there.
He writes, he goes, "Hi, Yeshai. I just listened to the end of the show. Great job as usual. My favorite part was your question to Ellie. Ellie Pieps last week.
Yeah, sure.
Whether or not Abbas just had a jihadi flip out when he went off on Trump like a crazy person. This is classic and so true. Regarding your Super Bowl challenge, I want to give you some chizuk. And indeed, Judah, you gave me chizuk. I just heard this morning that ratings for last week's playoffs were down 15% from the same weekend last year, which is the biggest year-over-year decline in NFL history. For whatever reason, including players kneeling for the anthem, players' injuries, boring play, ratings have been down overall this season. Personally, with my Giants out early, I took most of the year off and didn't really miss it. That being said, Super Bowl is a family-friends event, and while I love your idea, I don't think it will swing with the whole crew. But I will continue my practice of putting on a YU Torah video to replace the halftime show, which is an abomination. his words, or perhaps you'd like to provide some content instead. Uh-huh. Keep up the good word, Judah.
Next year, we have to do
a halftime video.
Halftime show.
Halftime show.
We're going to have to do it.
I know.
That was an invitation.
Yeah, and people have done it. There are if you go to YouTube, there are alternative halftime shows. And
I
people
think that
do
must
it.
Have to happen.
You know, but then again, I was thinking about that. Like, I certainly can recommend to you alternative halftime shows. Check out my video about the City of David. Check out my on Jewish Press. Check out you'll find it on YouTube. Check out my video about Hebron with Noam Arnon. And there's many other great videos that you can watch for 15, 20 minutes instead of the halftime show. But you know what, folks? Skip it all together. Still, I'm giving you another like moment here. Skip it together. Watch Masada the miniseries, okay? Instead, it's the best thing you'll ever watch ever on television. Order it on Amazon, okay? There's so many good things to do. Don't sit around watching people throw a ball around. It's so Roman, so silly, such a waste of time. You know what happens at the end of the Super Bowl? You're gonna have that like icky, non-satisfied feeling inside. You're just not gonna know why exactly.
Too many nachos.
Right? Like, why did I just spend three, four, 5 hours doing this?
Time?
Yeah, because they drayed out this whole thing. Who needs this? Instead, think about the splitting of the Red Sea. My God, so much more important, so much more exciting. Anyway, we got to hurry up here. We got to seal the deal on the show. The splitting of the Red Sea happens, but moreover, it also gets a song.
Oh, absolutely.
The song. In fact, this Shabbat is called Shabbat Shira, one of the Shabbos that gets a name. And it gets a name because how special it is to sing the Song of the Sea. One of the things that we in our prayers, there's many other things I would have put in our daily prayers, but this is one of the solid things.
My favorite.
Which is Az Yashir, then Moses shall sing, right? And the Song of the Sea, which, by the way, ends with, God's going to bring you to the Holy Land, beat back your enemies, and establish a temple that my hands have established.
That's right.
And that's how the story ends. It's not just about the victory over in the Red Sea.
And if we were going to go textually and an analysis, I could show you a number of places that, in many ways, the crossing the Red Sea is directly oriented toward the bringing of God's presence to earth, right? And its ultimate manifestation in the temple.
Right. Well, let's actually read a little bit. It's just the last two verses. Incredible. Tavi Amo, you shall bring him. This is verse 17, chapter 16. Chapter 15, verse 17. Tavi'emo v'titaemo behar nachalat nahat.
Tavi'emo. The deepest of biblical Hebrew.
V'titaemo behar nachalatcha. Okay, you shall bring him and you shall plant him, root him. Plant him in the mountain of your
inheritance.
Machon l'shivtecha pa'alta, you have created a place for your dwelling. Pa'alta Hashem,
right.
God, you have prepared a place for your presence to sojourn, to dwell. Thank you. Mikdash Hashem konenu yadecha, a sanctuary for God, have your hands prepared. From this comes the idea.
I'm just gonna tighten your grammar there. It's Mikdash. Adonai konanu yadecha, right? Right? Oh, Lord, your hands have prepared a sanctuary.
Mm-hmm.
It's not Mikdash Adonai.
Mm-hmm.
You can look in Rashi there. He speaks
Mikdash
it out.
Adonai konanu yadecha. Right. Not Mikdash Adonai konanu yadecha. Although that
it would work, but Rashi's absolutely opposed to it, both grammatically and midrashically.
Okay. And then finally, Hashem Yimloch Olam Va'ed.
Right, and then God will reign.
For eternity. So the song is very much, again, here is a moment of salvation per se. Wow, God, thanks for getting us out of Auschwitz. And then it's like, wait, but there's a much bigger thing here. Us getting out of Auschwitz is much bigger than that.
And listen, if you look at the beginning, Az Yashir Moshe Uvnei Yisrael Shiroza, right? Ze'eli v'anvehu, right? This is my God, and v'anvehu has a couple of meanings, but one of the understandings is and I will give him a dwelling place. Meaning the whole momentum here is that revelation in the sea could have been momentary. Like there's, like you're saying, the getting out of Auschwitz moment, the salvation moment is a revelatory moment because of that experience of being saved from death to life. But it's not enough, because the problem then is once you go on to live life in its normalcy, that revelation is lost like that. right? So the whole momentum here is then how do we as a people build a vessel that can hold the presence of God that we're experiencing in the moment of redemption forever? And that's the notion of the temple.
It would have been really swell, in my opinion, had the Torah portion ended right here. Because that's a lot to digest.
It is
and
a lot.
And it's like, okay, deep breath, everybody. That was awesome. You know, curtains, you know.
Curtains. At least.
Take five, everybody.
Yeah, exactly.
You know what I mean? Take five. Great job. Great crew. All right. You know what I mean? Let's take a break here. But nay.
Not even close.
Yeah, the Torah portion, keep on going. With big stuff. In fact, the high is not enough. In fact, it's going to end on a semi-low, shall we say, a kind of low in any case, in that we're going to go from there, Jewish complaints, that's going to be a problem, and then...
A little bit of bitterness.
There's going to be some bitterness, bitter waters, and then there's going to be the manna. That's a big one. The manna slash a related thing is the Sabbath. The Sabbath, as the first time it's given as a national commandment, is related to the manna bread, the manna
absolutely.
From heaven. It's a bit... I would say the text is it kind of bounces back and forth between these kind of twin issues between the Sabbath and the bread that God gives you, and He gives it to you throughout the week. Now, this manna bread is a key part of Jewish, not theological, I want to say, but like a life understanding, like a kind of.
It's a framework for understanding the world.
Right. It's like God provides you that day what you need. This is a pillar of faith. That's what I was looking for.
Uh-huh.
It's a pillar of faith. It's a pillar of faith in Judaism that God provides for us the manna bread every day. He gives us what we need, exactly what we deserve, on the level that we deserve.
And not only that, but that to spend our time tend to gather more than we are being given is just a waste of energy. Right, which is a real challenge. It's a real challenge in the world, especially the world after 2,000 years of exile, where we as a people have been very focused on accumulating as much as we can while we can get it.
Right.
Right? That just never make any mistake that we only get what God intends us to have.
Right.
And any excess is either going to be poison or an opportunity to do good for others.
Right.
And there's no way around that. And that's one of the great messages here, that the blessing of the Sabbath is bound up with the fact that God didn't give us. It's often missed that the great blessing of the Sabbath is that not today. Why? Because what's the real blessing in life? It's knowing you have what you need. And that's why, like, you know, we say, Kol mi she'torech be'erev Shabbat, ochel b'Shabbat. Anybody who does the work Erev Shabbat eats on Shabbat. And that doesn't just mean, of course.
You prepare for the Sabbath, you eat on the Sabbath.
Right, of course. Right. I made the chillin yesterday, so I'm going to eat it today. No, what it means is that the real pleasure in eating is being satisfied with the fact that you have what you need.
Right.
Right? Have you ever eaten a meal wondering whether there was enough to go around? It doesn't tend to lend itself to satisfaction.
Right, right.
Right? Food stress is not a physiological, it's a psychological state. And the great blessing of the Sabbath, not just in our food, but in our life in general, is that the consciousness of the Sabbath is, my work is done.
Here, by the way, there's two kinds of people in this world.
Uh-huh.
There's a Sabbath keeper and non-Sabbath keeper.
Momish, I can't
that's
wait.
It's just this time of week. There's two people in this world. And yeah. I'm talking about Jews and non-Jews. Meaning to say there are people, the Jews who keep the Sabbath, and the people who experience that, and then there's people who have not and just don't know what we're even talking about.
Yes.
But this Sabbath thing that's another like proof of the Jews. It's
another thing that makes us who we are.
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. It's a little bit ineffable. I find words.
By the way,
there's never been a movie. I was talking to my wife about movies about Jews. Like if there could be a movie about what is the Sabbath.
Right, it would be tough to film.
Tough to film. And like, what is the Sabbath?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I don't know that you could communicate it in
film.
Right,
I don't think you can.
But I want people who are listening, be they Jews or not, to take away the point that I was making there, because it's something you can cultivate as a practice in your life, which is that when that sun sets, you must embrace the fact that God is in charge and everything is done. It is an incredible joy. And listen, I live with a lot of chaos. I know you do too. We're busy people, and I know that it's a myth that all my work is done and that the world is perfect. But you know why we call Shabbat Me'ein Olam Haba? That it's a taste of the world to come. Because God is the Jewish people. We're the people that God put into the world to fix the place, to bring it to redemption. But how are we supposed to fix it without a blueprint, without knowing what it looks like? And the answer is Shabbat. God says now in your consciousness, in your behavior, in your families, in your communities, once a week. Just accept the fact that the world is done.
Mm-hmm.
And it can open up whole new dimensions for you.
And I'm going to take it from a completely different direction. Not you give the blueprint of what the world is supposed to look like. And I'll just say, to be an eternal people, it has its there's tricks to be an eternal nation. And one of the, there's tricks about purity and impurity. There's tricks about death.
Mm-hmm.
There's tricks about ritual
blessing,
impurity.
Blessing and curse.
Blessing and curse. One of our tricks to remain an eternal people is the regenerative power of the Sabbath.
Yes.
And it is regenerative, and it's also, what's the word I'm looking for here? The ability to pass it on to the next generation. There's something about the Sabbath which allows us to pass the knowledge DNA to our children. It's
yes.
a big part of it, and it's the only. It's a bonding time, and a time where we really send Judaism, our values, to the next generation, and perpetuate it. There's a perpetuative. And that's it's part of our secret, part of the secret of eternity.
Yeah, no question.
Remember what Mark Twain is like. What is his secret? He says, but the Jew is, you know.
The eternal Jew. Right,
right like well, what, and he says, and he finishes off that statement, but what is his secret?
Right.
So this is one of those secrets.
Definitely.
Okay, we'll have to finish off with one more last thing, and then we're done. Everything is more or less dandy. A little complaining of the Jews. A little.
It's hard. The wilderness. It's hot. It's
a little. Dry. A little fake news with some Jews who sprinkle some of the manna on the Sabbath day so that they could say there is no Sabbath and it just appears naturally. A little fake news there. Those guys get punished. But all in all, you know, great redemption, great presence from God, great awesome things, great song.
And then the epilogue.
Right. The epilogue is that there's a bad nation out there. That nation wants to challenge the Jewish people. And working in Hebron and living nearby, I could say for sure I have a recurring encounter with the forces of Amalek. I could say it with surety. And the anti-nation, the bizarro nation,
they are the anti-Israel.
The anti-Israel nation.
Because right. They're the other organizing principle for the world.
Right. Exactly. Definitely. They're out there, and they're out there to make battle with God vis-a-vis the Jewish people.
Yes. Well, if you're going to do one, you have to do the other.
Right. Or if you want to, it's the Tower of Babel. You want to fight God, fight the Jews.
That's right.
And so here they come.
You're
right.
The music today.
Right. It's like, I don't know. I'm seeing things very visually today.
I know, but the question is, what's the Amalek theme song in it?
Yeah.
Dun, 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 dun.
Yep. You know, and Amalek is tricky because he's also like. He can also appear like a superhero to some.
Oh, sure. And,
you know?
And sometimes eminently reasonable.
Right, right. The whole Amalek is not, it ain't no simpleton. And I just, yeah. In general, by the way, that's just one of my personal principles is never underestimate the enemy. Respect and fear the enemy. Like really, like honor the enemy as a serious enemy. Study the enemies. And I believe that in general. That's just I am against the people who think that the enemy is a dodo. I'm just against that. That's not my thing.
Well, I mean, you know, there's an old saying that you know a person by their enemies. So if,
right.
If you think your enemies are dodo, what are you?
Right. I firmly believe that the enemy is smart and has a goal, has a target, and is oftentimes more motivated than we are. I once said to Rabbi Fass of Nefesh B'Nefesh, I said to him, "Are we as motivated to save Jews as the Nazis were motivated to kill Jews? Are we as motivated to bring Jews to the land of Israel as Hitler was motivated to bring Jews into the fire?"
Well, if anyone is, he is.
Right. Okay. So that's why we had that conversation. Any case, Amalek strikes, comes at the Jewish people, hits our weak ones that are behind. Maybe either the people that have become ritually impure somehow, or the weaker
the stragglers.
Right.
The camp
somehow he strikes at the tail at the weaker edge. And by the way. Our enemies always strike at the weakest link.
That's
what happened in Gaza. It was the weakest political link in the Israeli thing. They strike at it. Today it's Hebron. Okay, they have understood that Jerusalem is a toughie.
Right. You don't go for the jugular at first.
Right. And they're going for the weaker. There's 70, whatever. There's 90 families there in Hebron. Strike, strike, strike. Try to get rid of those Jews out of there.
Right.
You'll never defeat us. But the point is that you know that's the efforts, that's the method. Strange method in return from the Jewish people. Moses sends forward his
lieutenant,
his top fighter, let's call it Joshua. And he goes out there, and Moses does something very different. Is that he's going to raise his hands. this is truly a little bit bizarre. When Moses' hands are up high, the Jewish people are victorious, and his hands are faithful. His hands at the same time get tired. He needs to sit down, and two of his lieutenants, it's going to be Hur, who's actually the son of Caleb, we could talk about that a different time, and Aaron, are going to be holding up his hands. And just imagine the battlefront. By the way, very painting-like image in my mind.
It's got to be out there somewhere.
Right. Can you see it? You see a battle between good and evil, and there's Moses out there holding his hands up, being held up, and with his hands being faithful, the Jewish people defeat Amalek.
I mean, it's a powerful image here that is this, you know, Yadav Emunah. His hands were faithfulness itself. Because, like Rashi says, is that his hands are outstretched in prayer. But it's so important that they were outstretched so that people could see him reaching out. Why? Because the great tool of Amalek is to make us think that the situation as we see it is the whole picture. Right? Just to narrow the focus down to what's happening right here. And just realize that the odds are against you. Realize that, no, you're making a mistake. Realize there's no God. Realize whatever it is I need to make you realize by narrowing your focus. And what's Moshe doing? He's just pointing upwards. He's saying, no, people, there's way more to it than that. You know, and in the book of Deuteronomy, when he retells us the story, there's a very important introduction, the question that brings Amalek into the world, actually, which is, Hayesh Hashem b'kirbeinu imayin. Right? Is God among us or not? Now you think about that. They just came through the Red Sea. They saw 10 plagues. They're following a pillar of fire. How could you ask a question like that? So that the answer is in the power of Amalek to take all that. Oh, that's, you know, we're going to decontextualize that. We're going to move that out of the frame. Just stay focused on what's happening right here, right now. And the greatness of Moshe stretching out his hands in prayer, saying, I refuse to accept the world as it is. I know that there is a God who's holding a context of what will be.
Right.
That's the image I see.
I like that very much. I like that very much. And I will add that to me, Moshe is the quintessential menorah of the Jewish people. Remember, he saw the burning bush. To me, that's the original menorah. And later on, we'll learn in Ki Tisa, he's going to come down off the mountain. His face is going to be lit up. He is the light. He is the light. And his hands outstretched towards heavens is, to me, in the shape of the menorah. Mm. And he's out there being the menorah. And he's saying, in this moment of darkness, we are light. We are light to the world. And never give up hope.
Yep.
And I like what you're saying. Like, see it from the grander perspective.
Well, that's why people give up hope, because they think they see the whole picture.
Right.
And there's no hope. You know, right. I see. I understand. The cold and analytical right. is a primary tool of Amalek.
And how great, great, great. And how important is it to be that beacon?
Yes.
That beacon to say,
even if it's just by pointing up and saying, right. no, there's more.
Right.
If that's all you do, people, then you are doing a great service to the world.
And that's what the menorah is in this world.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know what I mean? And when you're dealing with your taxes and when your kid's flipping out or somebody got in. By the way, here in Israel, we had a horrific car accident.
Oh, yes.
Children were killed, and the whole country is upset about this thing. You know, it's one of these dark moments. And you got to see that bigger thing. You got to see that bigger thing.
You got to reach for it.
You got to reach for it. Also, at the end, what's going to be, and we'll talk about this next week's Torah portion, is that the dark forces attacking is also a proof of what Israel is really up to. We'll talk about that next week. Rabbi Mike Ford, it's been an absolute pleasure to delve in with you into this Torah portion. People can reach you at RavMike@thelandofisrael.com and also follow you on Facebook.
And RavMike.com.
RavMike.com is flying, okay? It's like that menorah. And there's so much more content out there, including your other show, called The Jewish Story here at the Land of Israel. We have fabulous shows, really. I would like to think that this menorah is a broadcasting menorah, this Land of Israel network. And it's got great shows, Ari and Jeremy, Rabbi Shlomo, Eve Harrow, Gil Hoffman, Josh Haston. I think just doing great, great stuff. And if you plug into this thing, that light's going to shine off your face as well. And you have to be the rebroadcaster. I don't want you to, for one second, to think that you got to hear these shows, and be like, I got it. You know, you got to get it and send it out. You're a broadcaster. You're the one who's supposed to be filled with light and to send it to the world. When you hear the show, when you hear these shows, when you hear this Torah, it's really for you to be that light onto the nations and to the world. And I want you to be empowered to feel that way. Rabbi Mike, I want to thank you so much. I also want to thank all of our sponsors, our newest sponsor. That's the one we're going to be fixated on today. We're not going to talk about the other sponsors, except for like, the good folks at Chevron, which Chevronfund.org, Hebronfund.org, which helps you comes to see the mothers and the fathers. But today, and please, that's of course where I work. Please, friends, go to northernisrael.com, northisrael.com, northisrael.com/Yishai. And you're going to get, as you said, there's no free lunches. This time there is. But you're going to get information, the top 10 reasons why to invest in the North, and you'll get that free consultation about serious possibilities for you to invest in the land of Israel, in the future land of Israel, and actually invest in yourself as well. And really, you know, don't be one of those people who I've met throughout all of my travels who have said, I wish, I could have, I should have. Don't do it. Skip it. Skip the guilt thing. Skip the thing. Skip it. Go all the way to I did it, and I feel so good about it. I'm so proud about it. Okay?
Amen.
That's it, folks. Great show, Rabbi Mike Ford. Thanks again. I'm just having a hard time ending the show because I myself got so into wrapped up into the things we were talking about. And, of course, we were really touching
just the surface.
Just the surface. Incredible things in this Torah portion. I want to thank all of you out there. I want to thank again Tabitha. I want to thank Moshe. I want to thank Ben Bresky. I want to thank you wherever you are. And I want to thank God Almighty for giving us the opportunity to learn His Torah, to live in His land, to broadcast to the world His great message. And thank you, God, for bringing us back to Yerushalayim, Ir HaKodesh, the holy city, Jerusalem, and the ingathering of the exiles. Stay tuned, stay strong, stay connected. God bless you, and Shabbat Shalom.
The Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King said that the ultimate measure of a man is not where he stands in moments of comfort and convenience, but where he stands at times of challenge and controversy. Ours is a story filled with both challenge and controversy, but ultimately, it's also a story of hope and redemption. I'm Rav Mike Foyer, and this is The Jewish Story.
Join Rav Mike Foyer for the best Jewish history podcast, The Jewish Story, on the Land of Israel Network at thelandofisrael.com.
All right, folks, one more thing that I wanted to add to the end of the show, a little PS here. First thing, next Saturday night, I'm leaving for San Diego, Los Angeles, Phoenix, where my friend Jake Bennett is organizing a fantastic event. Write me an email and I'll get you information on the event that I'm doing in Phoenix. And then from there to Las Vegas for the RJC, for the Republican Jewish Convention. And I'll be out, and then New York City. I'll be in New York City for one day as well. So I'm heading out to those parts. And I want you to connect to me as I go around southwestern America in the desert a little bit, doing some driving, meeting people that want to be part of the story, connecting people to the story, overcoming some of the lies about the story, all that stuff. So please be connected. I won't be next week with Rabbi Mike Ford, but hopefully we'll put out a show. So that's next week, starting next Saturday night. Actually, next week we will have a show, and the week after we shan't have a show. So definitely, Rabbi Mike, hopefully Bezrat Hashem next week. But then we're going on the road. The show is going on the road. It's a little road show. Of course, we're going to Vegas, right? I also wanted to say that here's a few minutes of the Mike Pence speech that I thought that you should hear. Just a few minutes of this incredible speech that actually blew the minds of many Israelis who were like, whoa, I haven't heard that. The term that they're using is Zionist. They're like, that was a Zionist speech. Did you hear that Zionist speech? It was something a little bit surprising to some of the people who have been negatively affected by post-Zionism, even in our beloved Zion. So here's the vice president. Take it away, Mike Pence.
It is deeply humbling for me to stand before this vibrant democracy, to have the great honor to address this Knesset, the first vice president of the United States to be afforded that privilege, here in Jerusalem, the capital of the state of Israel. We stand with Israel because your cause is our cause. Your values are our values. And your fight is our fight. We stand with Israel because we believe in right over wrong, in good over evil, and in liberty over tyranny. We stand with Israel because that's what Americans have always done. And so has it been since my country's earliest days. During his historic visit to Jerusalem, President Trump declared that the bond between us, in his words, is woven together in the hearts of our people. And the people of the United States have always held a special affection and admiration for the people of the book. In the story of the Jews, we've always seen the story of America. It is the story of an exodus, a journey from persecution to freedom, a story that shows the power of faith and the promise of hope. My country's very first settlers also saw themselves as pilgrims, sent by providence to build a new promised land. The songs and stories of the people of Israel were their anthems, and they faithfully taught them to their children, and do to this day. And our founders, as others have said, turned to the wisdom of the Hebrew Bible for direction, guidance, and inspiration. America's first president, George Washington, wrote with favor to the children of the stock of Abraham. Our second president, John Adams, declared that the Jews, in his words, have done more to civilize man than any other nation. And your story inspired my forebears to create what our 16th president called a new birth of freedom. And down through the generations, the American people became fierce advocates of the Jewish people's aspiration to return to the land of your forefathers. To claim your own new birth of freedom in your beloved homeland. The Jewish people held fast to a promise through all the ages, written so long ago, that even if you'd been banished to the most distant land under the heavens, from there he would gather and bring you back to the land which your fathers possessed. Through a 2,000-year exile, the longest of any people anywhere, through conquests and expulsions, inquisitions and pogroms, the Jewish people held on to this promise. And they held on to it through the longest and darkest of nights. A night Elie Wiesel proclaimed, seven times sealed. A night that transformed the small faces of children into smoke under a silent sky. A night that consumed the faith of so many. It challenges the faith of so many still. And tomorrow, when I stand with my wife at Yad Vashem to honor the 6 million Jewish martyrs of the Holocaust, we will marvel at the faith and resilience of your people, who just 3 years after walking beneath the shadow of death rose up from the ashes to resurrect yourselves, to reclaim a Jewish future, and to rebuild the Jewish state. And this April, we will mark the day when the Jewish people answered that ancient question: can a country be born in a day? Can a nation be born in a moment? As the state of Israel celebrates the 70th anniversary of its birth. As you prepare to commemorate this historic milestone, I say, along with the good people of Israel, here and around the world, Shehekianu, Viki Amanu, Vihig Iyanu, Lazman Hazeh. Seventy years ago, the United States was proud to be the first nation in the world to recognize the State of Israel. But as you well know, The work we began on that day was left unfinished. For while the United States recognized your nation, one administration after another refused to recognize your capital. But just last month, President Donald Trump made history. He righted a 70-year wrong. He kept his word to the American people when he announced that the United States of America will finally acknowledge Jerusalem is Israel's capital. The Jewish people's unbreakable bond to this sacred city reaches back more than 3,000 years. It was here in Jerusalem on Mount Moriah that Abraham offered his son, Isaac, and was credited with righteousness for his faith in God. It was here in Jerusalem that King David consecrated the capital of the Kingdom of Israel. And since its rebirth, the modern state of Israel has called this city the seat of its government. Jerusalem is Israel's capital. And as such, President Trump has directed the State Department to immediately begin preparations to move the United States Embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. In the weeks ahead, our administration will advance its plan to open the United States Embassy in Jerusalem. And that United States Embassy will open before the end of next year. Our president made his decision, in his words, in the best interest of the United States. But he also made it clear that we believe that his decision is in the best interest of peace. By finally recognizing Jerusalem as Israel's capital, the United States has chosen fact over fiction. And fact is the only true foundation for a just and lasting peace. Under President Trump, the United States of America remains fully committed to achieve a lasting peace between Israelis and Palestinians.
All right, folks, you are listening to the Yishai Fleisher Show. I hope you enjoyed some of those words, those inspirational words of Governor Mike Pence, Vice President of the United States of America, who stood at the podium at the Knesset in Jerusalem and reminded us about Zionism. Of course, about Father Abraham. Folks, stay tuned, stay strong, stay connected, be part of it wherever you are. Never be afraid. Let them hear you roar. God is fulfilling his dream, and you're a part of it wherever you are. Shalom, and bless you.